From WBUR Boston, I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, we got our first unsettling glimpse of the accused Colorado shooter, 24-year-old James Holmes. He looked wild-eyed and out of it. His lawyer was forced to nudge Holmes to stand when the judge entered the courtroom. Aurora Police Chief Daniel Oates told the media that Holmes had purchased 6,000 rounds of ammunition allegedly used in the massacre through the internet.
My understanding is that all the weapons that he possessed legally, and all the clips that he possessed legally, and all the ammunition that he possessed legally.
The horrors of such massacres captures the national attention. Who is this person who would do such a thing? But the power of the NRA is such that almost every effort at gun control has been roundly defeated for decades. This hour on Point, the hopeless politics of gun control. You can join the conversation. How highly do you value your Second Amendment rights? Has this weekend shooting changed your feelings towards gun ownership? Confirmed it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Byers, Colorado, is Glenn Rotkovich, owner of the Lead Valley Range. The range serves over 400 members, most of them coming from Denver. In June, Aurora, Colorado shooter James Holmes applied to join the shooting range, but drew Rotkovich's suspicion after a disturbing answering machine message he heard. He instructed employees not to grant Holmes a membership if he called back or showed up. Glenn, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Wade.
I understand that you have one of the most popular gun ranges in Colorado. Tell me a little bit about the Lead Valley Range.
We're very comprehensive. We're the most comprehensive range in the state, with everything from archery to long-range shooting, traps, five-stand skeet, this type of things. We basically can do everything in one place.
And I was interested to see that it's a family gun range. For our listeners, you know, who don't know a whole lot about this, how do you make a gun range family-friendly?
Well, you make it family-friendly because we allow anybody to bring their family and teach their children how to handle firearms in a safe manner, be familiar with them, just like you would do anything else. You teach your children not to handle a hot stove and burn themselves. Well, that's nothing more than another way of protecting your children, by teaching them what something is so that they know how to deal with it in a safe manner and not hurt themselves.
It's extremely popular, and membership spots are scarce, but one came open and you called James Holmes. I guess he was next on the list. What happened?
Well, he had sent me an application and we looked at it, and the application was filled out properly, so I called him to see if he was, you know, would make the next orientation, because that's mandatory for the range. And instead, I got an answering service machine, whatever, and it was it had a very deep, bass, guttural, rambling, incoherent message on it that just said, "What the hell was that?"
Talk to me a little bit about it. Was it because you couldn't understand him, or was it the tenor of his voice, or both?
It was all of the above. I mean, he was, like I said, you could tell somebody deliberately lowered their voice to make it have a sound, and at the same token, it was, you know, rambling and incoherent. I heard the word James, I heard the word message, you know, and that was about all that was distinguishable. And I, be honest, I didn't spend the time to try to, you know, hear it again and say, okay, let me see what he was really saying.
What did you think after you hung up?
Just what I had said to you earlier. What on earth is that supposed to be, you know? You could tell it was deliberately to be something, but I had no clue what it was supposed to be.
And you thought enough about it to instruct your employees. What did you say?
Well, again, because of the shortage here, an additional flag was that most of the time when I call somebody and say, hey, you know, I have your application, I need to talk to you about it, they call within 2 hours. The 90% of the people call the first day. So I very seldom ever call anybody a second time. Well, he didn't call back, so I'd left a message a second and a third time. Well, by then it's like, you know, you sent me an application, you want to do it, you've got this bizarre message, and you're not calling me? No, I think we're done. And then I just told them things on the day of orientation. I told the staff, this guy's not scheduled. If he shows up, sit him down someplace, get me, he doesn't get processed anything until I talk to him. I want to know what's going on.
I was struck by the whole thing. Mostly I would think you would take your customers as they come. Do you often give prospective members a look over?
We talk to all of our members before they join. That's the normal process. We're also instructors, firearm instructors. I teach instructors. And we always talk to all of our people before we do anything with them, because the most important thing of gun safety is attitude. If a person does not have a good attitude, they're not going to be a good gun owner or a good person. Attitude is everything in everything we do in the world. And that's one of the most important things that we do, is we look at people and their attitude and towards firearms and what they think and what they're doing. And if that's not there, I don't want to deal with them.
Tell me about your reaction when you began to realize that this guy was the shooter from the theater. How did you begin to realize it, and what did you think?
Well, we found it. I was watching everything unfold the morning like everybody else, and I got a phone call from one of my staff members on our way to work and said, "Lynn, wasn't the name of the guy you flagged James Holmes?" And I said, "Yeah, why?" She said, "They just said that's the name of the shooter." I said, "Oh, great." And so about that time, the station I was watching said it too. So I went and found the application and looked at it and looked at the address on it. And basically the address was the location that a reporter was standing talking about his apartment. I looked at the bottom of it. The emergency contact gave his mother in San Diego. So it was like, all right, it's the shooter. Too many coincidences not to be. And my reaction at that point was, thank you, Lord, for not having us to have to mess with him.
And you thought, I knew it.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I don't. I knew something was right. Well, something wasn't right is what I knew. Beyond that, I didn't know. I didn't know anything other than the fact that I didn't like what was going on. And I've spent most of my life dealing with people and either hiring people, firing people, managing people, doing stuff with people. And I've learned to just go with suspicions, whatever you have. Tend to believe them and check them out and see where it takes you.
It sounds like your instincts are dead on. Thank you so much for telling the story and joining us, Glenn.
All right.
Glenn Rotkovich is the owner of the Colorado Shooting Range, and that James Holmes applied to join before he opened fire on a packed theater in Aurora, Colorado this past weekend. Joining us now from Seattle, Washington, is Dave Workman, Director of Communications for the Second Amendment Foundation and Senior Editor of GunMag.com. Dave, welcome to On Point.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Wade.
I know that you deplore what happened in Colorado. What effect do these massacres involving young men have on the gun owner community?
Well, I think we are already seeing that the typical reaction from the gun control crowd is to start talking about reviving gun control. They want to limit the amount of ammunition that somebody can purchase. There's been talk about renewal of the ban on so-called assault weapons, about waiting periods, background checks. This is almost the same thing that we hear every time there is one of these types of incidents, which they're still rare, but when something like this does occur, it ramps up the rhetoric and people get involved in a conversation about this.
Does it concern you, or you just let it pass by your shoulder?
Well, for me, it's I cover it like a story. I address it because I am a journalist and I try to take a step back, but I'm not afraid to correct people when I know they're making a mistake, when, for example, something is said that I know is nonsense about the law. I write about that and explain that to my readers, at least, to keep everything as factual as possible. But as a person, it alarms me a little bit, because I know that there are better ways to deal with this kind of a situation than to start screaming at each other and poking holes in the air with your finger. If we sit down and have a legitimate conversation about this, where we can have a meeting of the minds. I think that's a better way to handle this sort of situation than to, for everybody to pick a corner and start yelling at each other.
I'm from Texas, and I know a lot of gun owners there, and many of them believe that the more citizens who carry concealed weapons and the more places that they are allowed to carry them, the safer the world will be. Do you agree?
Well, I don't disagree. There are certain places where naturally we wouldn't expect somebody to be armed, like in a courtroom, for example, or walk into a prison with a concealed handgun. But in places of that are open to the public, I don't see a problem with that, because these shootings that we have seen have invariably happened in places where people have been disarmed, either by a posting by the property owner or by statute, you know, a school, a college, shopping malls, that sort of place. And those are pretty much target-rich environments for people who want to create mayhem when nobody can fight back.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the politics of gun control. Yesterday on MSNBC's Morning Joe, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says there needs to be progress on gun control.
All we're talking about here are reasonable restrictions. Nobody's going to take away your right to bear arms, to hunt, and that sort of thing. But when you see a rifle that's advertised on the internet, able to bring down a commercial airliner at a mile and a half, that's not going after deer.
With us this hour is Dave Workman, Director of Communications at the Second Amendment Foundation. Dave, you know, let's say that there had been armed citizens inside that movie theater. You think the argument still holds? I mean, I worry about citizens opening fire under all circumstances, but especially in a dark, crowded, chaotic movie theater.
Well, yeah, and I've had this conversation with some other people over the last few days, as you might have guessed. Inside of a dark theater where apparently he set off a smoke bomb and a tear gas grenade, you've got incredible chaos. People probably were screaming, trying to get out, tripping over each other. It was, again, dark. And in the midst of that, you've got muzzle flashes and muzzle blasts that can completely disorient people, probably worse than just a battlefield. It's not clear to me that anybody would have been able to get a decent shot at this guy to take him out. Somebody who was close enough perhaps might have been able to shoot him and distract him. I understand he was wearing some sort of body armor. Probably wouldn't have killed him, but it might have taken him off his feet long enough to distract him to get people out of there. You know, we don't know because it didn't happen. And until something like that does happen, we can't really fairly analyze a thing like that. The internet's been full of remarks from people that I call mall ninjas and keyboard commandos, the kind of chest-thumping sort of thing that, you know, I could have done this, I could have done that. Well, nobody really knows what one could have done in a situation like that. And I've been near crime scenes when gunshots were going off, so I sort of reserve judgment on that sort of thing.
I'd like to have Dan Gross. He's from New York. He's president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. He's also the co-founder and former director of the Center to Prevent Youth Violence, formerly known as PACST, to join us. Dan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Wade.
What do you think of the argument that an armed society is a polite society?
Tell that to Trayvon Martin's parents. You know, the basic fact is this notion that the gun lobby, and, you know, let's be clear what this is. This is a lobby that's interested in selling more guns, represented by a few extremists who don't represent the voice of the overwhelming majority of Americans. You know, they want you to think that more guns equals more safety, and in no place is the insanity of that better exemplified than in the argument that you know you were just talking about, that if citizens had guns in these situations, that tragedies like this could have been prevented. We have somebody on our staff who was shot 4 times in the tragedy at Virginia Tech. That was not in a dark, crowded theater, but it was just as chaotic and frenzied. And he has to endure every day people telling him that if someone had a gun, they might have been able to prevent that tragedy from happening. The reality is a gun in a situation like that makes it far more dangerous. My brother was shot in a shooting that happened on the observation deck of the Empire State Building. Pure chaos. And everybody that I've talked to that was there, as well as the hundreds of other people that I've talked to that have been involved with these mass tragedies, they all say that having a gun in that situation would have only increased the likelihood that more people would have been killed.
What are the ramifications of a culture in which a significant segment of the population is armed in public? And in Texas, there's a movement, and in many other states, to have these weapons be not concealed but carried openly on the hip.
Listen, I don't write off the possibility that in certain circumstances, guns can be protective, and this might surprise your guest from the Second Amendment Foundation. I also completely respect the Second Amendment as it's now been definitively ruled on by the Supreme Court. It provides a right to bear arms in the home. Also, the Scalia majority opinion said that that can be regulated for the purpose of public safety, especially as it relates to being outside the home. So, you know, I do think that with proper discretion from law enforcement officers, which they don't have in far too many states, you know, there can be situations where people can carry guns for protection. But I don't feel that somebody like George Zimmerman, a man with an arrest record and a history of violence, should have been walking around with a loaded hidden gun when the night he killed Trayvon Martin. And let's be clear that that is what the gun lobby and the politicians who have done their bidding have fought for. They wanted him to be carrying that gun that night. They put that gun in his hands. And when you equate that with the notion of an armed society as a polite society, it doesn't add up.
Let's take some calls. Mary from Mason, New Hampshire. Hello, Mary.
Hi, Wade. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I was calling to let you know I was involved in a shooting on September 12th of last year. My boyfriend's ex-wife shot from outside the house 4 times into my head, once in my chest and once into my arm. She also shot at my daughter, who threw up her hand to protect her head. So she got her in the hand and shot my boyfriend in the back twice. She had just been released from a psychiatric hospital and was still able to obtain the gun that she shot us all with. And then she sat on the front porch and killed herself.
Why? Dave, what about situations like this where we have people who may well be seriously mentally ill?
Well, maybe we should define the question a little bit. People who are seriously mentally ill and who have been adjudicated mentally ill cannot legally possess their own firearms, can't buy a gun legally. I don't know where this lady got the firearm. And in a case like that, certainly the law didn't seem to work. And I'm not sure what happened leading up to this, so we've got Mary's account of that, and I'd like to talk to her more to find out exactly what did happen there.
But it does not seem that mental illness is a barrier that is insurmountable to gun ownership. We see that quite a bit.
Hey, Wade, let me tell you why. And, you know, because I just want to point out what's going on here. Your guest just pointed out that that it was not legal for somebody who was adjudicated to be mentally ill to have a gun. That is true. But the only way to prevent that is with a background check. And the gun lobby at every turn fights, and you heard, you know, you heard him reference to it before. You know, that's looked at as an infringement on Second Amendment rights, according to the Supreme Court, is not. Without background checks, you know, the Brady Law was passed, and that has applied to 60% of all gun sales. But there are 40% of gun sales, including gun shows, including private sales over the internet, that are not subject to background checks. So while it was illegal for that person to have a gun, why does the gun lobby at every turn fight background checks? That, by the way, the overwhelming majority of the American public supports. This is not as a controversial an issue in the American consciousness as we think it is. And the one thing I will agree with that Dave, your other guest, said is that we do need to have a meaningful national conversation about this. But we need to genuinely come to the table with respect for each other's opinions and respect for the bottom line, which is how can we prevent tragedies like this from happening? Not the bottom line in terms of how many guns we can sell. And I just put it out there. I respect the Second Amendment. I respect it exactly like it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court. How can we now talk about opportunities to save lives, opportunities like background checks that can prevent tragedies? I don't stammer when I answer this woman and she talks about this tragedy. I say it very likely could have been prevented if this person was dangerously mentally ill and they bought their gun without a background check.
Okay, Dave?
Well, first, the background check, the National Instant Check System, certainly was supported by the firearms community. Back in 93 and 94, and I remember that because I was involved in that conversation. Background checks have prevented some people from buying guns. They've prevented a lot of people from buying guns who actually were mistaken for somebody else. They had the same name, maybe the same age, and these things were cleared up later. But somebody who is seriously mentally ill, naturally, nobody wants them to have a firearm. I don't know how this lady acquired that firearm, if she got it from a family member or if she stole it. That hasn't been explained. So, you know, I'd like to find out more about this case.
Okay, let's take another caller. John from Boston, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you, Wade. I'm a gun owner and a business person, and I've been a strong advocate for the Second Amendment. As it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court, which said you can't ban guns, but you can have reasonable restrictions on how they are made and sold. And that Second Amendment has been interpreted by the NRA to mean that you can have unrestricted access to all guns, even criminals and terrorists. And the dirty little secret as a gun owner who goes to a gun store and is happy to succumb to a background check is that criminals and terrorists, even Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, have been proven to go to the 33 states, including Michigan, gun shows where they can buy military-style assault weapons, cash and carry, without an ID or a background check. So federal gun policy is to allow for unrestricted access to guns unless you're stupid enough to go to a gun store. And so if you want to reduce injuries and deaths without banning guns, you simply need to restore the federal ban on assault weapons. Between 1994 and 2004, when the ban was in effect, the federal assault weapon ban, there was a 66% reduction in those 19 weapons, including an AR-15 like Holmes used in Colorado and high-capacity ammunition clips. There was a 66% reduction in those guns showing up in crime. So if you want to reduce injuries and deaths from guns versus provide unrestricted access to guns, which Congress and the NRA seem to be going along with, the Republican Party has, for all intents and purposes, become owned by lock, stock, and barrel by the NRA, and the Democratic Party is intimidated and scared into submission. But if you want to reduce injuries and deaths from guns, it's not hard. Do what Massachusetts has done. Background check requirement. Consumer protection standards like exist for toy guns and teddy bears, but not real guns that result in 150 people shot a day, 83 killed a day, and there's not even a consumer protection standard for how guns are made or marketed.
Okay, thanks, John. I appreciate it. I'm going to take another caller, Alan from Newport.
Thanks, Wade. Thanks for taking my call. We could ban all the guns. And as we found out during Prohibition, when they banned alcohol, they had plenty of alcohol, and that would happen. The guns would go underground. But you have to look at it this way. There's other weapons. Several Molotov cocktails probably would have done more damage than the individual with the guns. And in the Middle East, they use these bomb packs that they wear to strap to the body and go in the crowd, and they kill many more than were killed in the theater. So the banning of guns is not going to solve the problem. We have to look at the individuals, and that individual that did the shooting in Colorado definitely showed signs of being mentally ill.
Dan, talk to me about the idea that it's too late, that guns and ammunition are everywhere, and it's hopeless to try to do anything now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that I just flat out reject. I think we have to come to this table with a sense of hopelessness, and we have to come to this table with the notion of what we can do to prevent tragedies. Yes, we are never going to prevent every tragedy from happening, but we can save a whole lot of lives if we can keep guns out of the hands of convicted felons, convicted domestic abusers, terrorists, people found to be dangerously mentally ill. And universal background checks is one good example of how we can do that within the definition of the Second Amendment handed down the ruling by the Supreme Court. And, we just need to take a step back and reframe this whole conversation. As a nation, we are better than this. And that's why we've created a separate website that's just wearebetterthanthis.org. You know, there's a petition on there now for the American public to ask President Obama and Mitt Romney to provide us with solutions. It doesn't suggest any specific solutions, but we need to come to the table talking about solutions. So when this gentleman says we can ban all guns and there will still be gun violence and it'll go, nobody wants to ban all guns. We have to move past that. And we have to say, how can we all come to a table in the context of looking for solutions to save lives with mutual respect? So the only thing that I just kind of flat out reject is when other people flat out reject any area of the potential solution. So, for example, you had Glenn on earlier from the Lead Valley Range talking about how he teaches gun safety, and that's important. That's an important part of this conversation. Sure, he should teach if people are going to have guns in their home, they should know if they want to make that choice, they should understand gun safety. But let's not just write off blanketly the possibility that there are reasonable regulations that can be passed within the context of the Second Amendment that can help save lives. I mean, I think when somebody just blanketly says laws won't work, so we shouldn't look at them. I think that's the point where you have to seriously question people's agenda.
I was in doing research for this show. I was interested to see that since 1990, that American public opinion that the gun control side is losing ground. Still a majority of Americans favored, but from 80% down to 52%. Given the fact that we've had massacre after massacre in this country, what do you think's going on?
The latest poll is actually even worse than that. It shows that when it's asked that way, do you support tighter gun control? It's actually only 44%. However, when you ask in terms of specific sensible regulations like background checks, so a convicted felon can't walk into a gun show and buy a gun, 80-90% of Americans, gun owners, everybody supports those ideas. So we have to stop thinking about this in terms of control and taking guns away. But the sensible regulations that the overwhelming majority of Americans already support.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. This hour, we're talking about the hopeless politics of gun control. With us this hour is Dave Workman, Director of Communications at Second Amendment Foundation. Also joining us from New York is Dan Gross, President of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Violence. And joining me now from New York is Craig Whitney, longtime reporter, foreign correspondent, and editor for the New York Times till his retirement in 2009. And he has a new book coming out called Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. Thanks for joining us, Craig. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Wade.
Well, Craig, what's a nice liberal like you making a pro-gun case like this?
Well, my point was in doing the book to try to understand what the Second Amendment really is all about and why we have such pointless arguments about gun ownership in the United States, and we keep having these massacres like the one in Aurora. And what I found was that if you look back at the history, the Second Amendment didn't create a new right to keep and bear arms. It simply recognized a common law right that American colonists had ever since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock to have firearms for self-defense, but also it was connected to civic duty. And in those days, that was when if you had a firearm, you had to be able to use it and come when the militia called to defend your community or your state in a militia. And I think today what's been lost, particularly on the side of the gun rights people and the NRA in particular, is any sense of civic responsibility or civic duty. Americans who own guns are not a law unto themselves. That's not what the Second Amendment makes them. And how do they behave and constructively discuss with others who are concerned about public safety? How do we keep things like these periodic massacres we have from happening? If we do nothing and stay in an impasse, we're just going to have another one.
You say that you're making a liberal's case for the Second Amendment. Are you hoping to convince more liberals to cross over? And if so, what's the best your best argument?
Well, I'm impressed by what I hear from Dan Gross. It's not what the gun lobby and the NRA have convinced most of their members that the Brady organization stands for. And I think that you've got what proponents of better and more intelligent gun controls have to do is convince those people who are on the other side that their object is, as Dan said, not to seize guns or deprive everybody of the right to have guns if they're law-abiding, but how to keep them out of the hands of people who everybody agrees shouldn't have them. And I certainly agree that tightening up the loophole that allows private sales at gun shows or elsewhere to go bypass the NICS background check is would certainly be one of the easiest ways and most effective ways to make sure that people who shouldn't have guns don't get a hold of them legally.
Let's take a caller. Alan from Biloxi, Mississippi. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Wade. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like to say that, this guy that in Aurora, if he didn't have access to those guns, he could have went in there and just blown up the theater with a homemade bomb. One of the things, this guy, he definitely had mental illness. He wants notoriety. He went in there to do that. He shot those people, went outside, and waited in his car for the police to show up. This guy thinks that there's going to be a documentary made about him. You know, he thinks he's going to be famous. And, you know, one of the problems we have in this country is when someone does something like this, they get automatic documentary, you know? It's just not right. These people should be buried under a rug, never to be spoken about again. And I think a background check is a good thing. They should have a waiting period. Gun shows should be regulated. Most people have guns. If a guy goes to buy, an amount of guns like this guy did and the ammunition and he's a new gun owner, that should be looked into. You should have a gun card just like you have a driver's license. And, there's many gun collectors out there. Guns are pretty neat. In the history of our country, there's all types of guns. I mean, there's no end to guns. But there's also no end to people that can come up with a way to harm other people if their sick mind decides they want to do it. I mean, I've had many guns in my life. I've had guns since I was 12 years old. I had a 410 shotgun over under, you know, and I always had respect for guns, and I have respect for people, animals, and trees, and I don't shoot any of those.
Great. Dave, I haven't seen anything that indicates that there was any way to stop Mr. Holmes from buying these guns. Background checks, I don't think anything, I don't see, nothing I've seen indicates that there was anything amiss in him purchasing 6,000 rounds over the internet or a bunch of guns at a gun shop.
I think you've pinpointed something there, Wade. Even some of the authorities, and I've read their quotes in various news stories over the last few days, have said that there was no way they could have prevented this. Let's make something perfectly clear here. Mr. Holmes, who allegedly did this crime, he did not buy these guns at gun shows. This gun show thing always comes up in these conversations. Gun shows had absolutely nothing to do with this crime. Mr. Holmes purchased these firearms at retail. He purchased them at four different times. He went through four different background checks. He cleared all of them. The guy that Naveed Haq, who's been convicted of the Jewish Center shooting here in Seattle a few years ago, he cleared two background checks to purchase handguns at two different gun shops in the Tri-Cities area before he drove over here and broke in and opened fire at that place. The agenda here seems to be to demonize gun shows when gun shows have nothing to do with this. And as far as having 6,000,
can I chime in here?
Yeah, I mean, but I actually do want. I mean, Dan, if you can hold it together, and I want to shoot a congresswoman, or I want to shoot my fellow students at a university, and I can kind of keep my murderous impulses from you know coming out inappropriately at a gun shop, I can do everything legally, no problem.
There, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. There's nothing that we can do to prevent every one of these tragedies from happening. That's the danger in looking at any one specific tragedy to point us to the specific solutions in terms of what we can do to save a lot of lives. Nobody is trying to demonize gun shows or gun owners or even guns. We are trying to demonize the loss of innocent life. And I think, again, if we can all come to the table looking at it from that perspective, we can back the solutions that the overwhelming majority of Americans already support, like background checks, and prevent these tragedies from happening. There are two things we can't do. We can't succumb to the defeatist attitude that these things will happen anyway to prevent us from looking for solutions to stop a lot of them from happening. And we have to stop defining this conversation by single tragedies because, yes, perhaps in this instance, this man might have been able to get his gun anyway with the law. Maybe if there were an assault weapons ban in place, you know what? Maybe he wouldn't have been able to get that gun. We don't know. But we do know that there are thousands of deaths that occur every year because convicted felons, dangerously mentally ill, people who would be stopped through background checks, get a hold of guns, yes, legally. So in that regard, we agree with the gun lobby. It's about enforcing laws that currently exist. But you have to enforce those laws with other laws like background checks. We have to start having a dialogue. And your last caller exemplified it. Gun owner says, you know, these things are going to happen anyway, but we have to look at the things that we can do. That exemplifies the dialogue that we need to have. And that's why separate from Brady, wearebetterthanthis.org. Participate in the dialogue. Dave, you're welcome to go and participate in that dialogue as well. Let's sign the petition. Let's ask Mitt Romney and President Obama to provide solutions.
Dan, let me ask you a question. I see you standing bravely out front, and I look at the state legislatures, and I look at Congress and the Senate, and you look fairly lonely out there. Where are your political allies?
It's lonely in terms of political allies. It's not lonely in terms of the American public being behind me. And we need to do a better job capturing this voice that clearly exists. When you look at all the polling around these sensible measures that don't infringe on the Second Amendment right to bear arms, firearms as it's been defined by the Supreme Court. The overwhelming majority of Americans support those. And yes, shame on us, shame on Brady for not capturing that voice of the American people and applying it to sensible change that we all can agree to. But I'm new to this gig, and that's going to change. This is going to be a respectful conversation where gun owners and non-gun owners alike, red staters, blue staters, Republicans and Democrats can come to the table with one thing in mind, which is how can we save lives? Because as a nation, we all know we are better than this. That's why the website is wearebetterthanthis.org.
You have to have somebody on the other side who's willing to respond to that as well. And you remember what happened in 2011 when President Obama called for a dialogue about gun rights, saying he supported the Second Amendment and the American's individual right to have firearms. And what did Wayne LaPierre of the NRA say? Why should I waste my time with these people who want to take away my Second Amendment rights?
Craig, you were a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. You lived in London and Paris, and you saw up close what life is like in cultures where guns are not ubiquitous. And these are places where you can often count the number of gun deaths each year on your fingers and toes. Why didn't those experiences convince you of the wisdom of a gun-free culture?
Because even in societies like Great Britain and Germany and Norway, where there's very strict gun control and very few guns relatively to our situation in private hands, you still have occasional incidents like this. The worst gun massacre of modern history occurred in Norway a year ago, where 69 people were killed by a gunman, a single gunman. So strict gun control alone is not the answer, is what I conclude.
I'm going to take a caller, Terry from Omaha, Nebraska. Terry, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine.
Here's the deal. The problem isn't with the rifles or any of that stuff. It's with the NRA blocking the fact that these people have access to magazines that hold 100 rounds. I'm a Marine, and I was in a gunfight on a daily basis, and I was restricted to 20 rounds. This is absolutely stupid that somebody could get a rifle and have that many rounds. That's why we have those high casualty counts in these civilian encounters. It's insane. But my second point is, I don't want to restrict gun ownership. I don't want to restrict carrying guns. I do want to restrict concealed weapons. If you want to carry a gun, you carry it on the outside of your body, outside of your clothing, preferably on your chest with a blaze orange holster. That way, people know who's armed and who's not armed, and if they feel that insecure to walk into a public place without carrying a gun, well, they need to tell everybody that that's the way they feel. And I'm absolutely convinced that if they were to pass those kinds of regulations, we'd be done.
All right, I'd like to take another caller, Jim from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jim, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Wade. I have a question, and it's surrounding the prevalence of gun violence in Camden, New Jersey, where there seems to be a lot of legally purchased firearms brought into Camden from Philadelphia. I just want to ask your guest, what does he think is a fair amount of guns for a person to legally purchase?
Dave, I think that's to you.
I'm not exactly sure what we're talking. If you're talking about gun trafficking, there are laws against that already.
No, I think he's asking you what's a reasonable amount of weapons and a reasonable amount of ammo. Should there be a limit? I think he's asking.
Well, I know people who purchase more than one or two firearms a month, and I think that's where we're going. When you start putting limits on firearms, ammunition, you know, one gun a month can become one gun every 6 months. It can be one gun a year. I see that as the slippery slope. But I'd like to get back and respond to something Dan was saying earlier, where he's not trying to demonize gun shows. And this is not a personal thing, but the Brady campaign and other gun prohibition organizations have always tried to demonize gun shows. I mean, this is something that they've done. It's the quote-unquote gun show loophole, which I don't know whether that exists or not. But and he also talks about how background checks should be able to keep felons from obtaining guns, buying guns. These guys get their guns. They don't go through background checks. They don't buy them at retail outlets. They get them off the street. They get them from acquaintances. They get them in burglaries. They steal them from police officers. I'm not sure exactly where you can say that by adopting a background check, we've prevented a lot of felons from getting guns because they still get the guns. And as far as someone being able to have a concealed firearm and respond in an emergency situation, we saw that a couple of weeks ago down in Florida, and I think it was Ocala, where these two thugs broke in. It's on video. The video's all over the internet. These guys, one of them was armed with a metal baseball bat. The other one had a handgun. They came in. They started yelling, "Hey, anybody move, we're going to kill you." There's a 71-year-old man in there whose back is turned to these guys. At a particular moment in the video, he turns around. He draws his legally carried .380 semi-automatic pistol, gets two shots off at the first guy, hits him. They start running. He fires again, hits the second bad guy, chases him to the door. He stops at the door. They ran out the door and were later apprehended by the police in hospitals
so
where they were trying to be—
There is so deceptive rhetoric in what
you're
saying,
Dan?
Dave, let Dan answer.
No, Wade, I'm not going to let him do that because he's been—
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm going to let him answer. It's my show.
There's so much dangerous and deceptive rhetoric in that. You know, you talk about one example where something happens. Who knows what the actual circumstances were of it? Every study shows that an armed society is not, in fact, a polite society. That having guns everywhere in public just leads to more danger. Trayvon Martin's parents can tell you that in the state of Florida. The bottom line is, you are not coming to this table looking for solutions. You're coming to this table looking for reasons to defeat sensible gun laws at every turn. You're from the Second Amendment Foundation. You're representing the gun lobby, trying to sell more magazines, and the American people want better than that.
Thank you, Dan. I'm going to have to— we're coming up on a break. Dave Workman, Director of Communications for the Second Amendment Foundation, thank you for being with us. Dan Gross, Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, thanks to you as well. And Craig Whitney, author of Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment, thanks very much for being here. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.